Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
I have traveled this country from one end to another, and I come back to Boston, Massachusetts.
The historic startup culture is astounding.
Everybody do your job.
And together we're going to make Boston even stronger.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
I'm Peter Barnes with Pat Carroll.
And I'm Janet Wu, in for Tom Maroney.
On our show tonight, more on the shakeup at GE. John Flannery out, Larry Culp in. But did the company go far enough with its executive changes? Does it need to shake up its board now? We'll ask our Bloomberg Opinion columnist, Brooke Sutherland, who has some strong opinions on these matters at 4:16.
The leader of our nation's central banking system is in Boston today. We'll let you know what he had to say about the state of our economy and interest rates. We'll have analysis from our Bloomberg Federal Reserve reporter at 4:47.
You know, it's October now, so that means Halloween, right?
Yes, but I still think it's too soon, but go on.
What is the biggest Halloween spot in the state of Massachusetts?
Beacon Hill, I would say.
Salem. Salem is limiting the number of people who will be allowed inside a historic cemetery, which of course has a direct link to the 1692 witch trials. The Salem News says on Saturdays and Sundays during October and on Halloween night, they will let no more than 100 people inside the Charter Street burial ground at a time, and they will be monitoring. They started doing this last year because there were big crowds and people were eating, changing diapers on the tombs and, you know, not very respectful. This cemetery was established in 1637. It is the burial site of two of the judges who presided over the witch trials. And as somebody who performed in the Crucible in high school, this is of interest to me.
I got the answer wrong. You're right. Salem is a place to be for all the Halloween stuff. But as far as really great trick-or-treating and candy consumption,
okay.
Beacon Hill for sure.
Okay.
And what are you all going to get dressed up as for Halloween? I know what I'm going to get dressed up as.
A news anchor?
I'm getting dressed up as Tom Maroney. Of course.
You'll just have to wait and
see. Our own great pumpkin.
You'll have to wait and see.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about GE here because Mr. Culp, his first day on the job, as Pat reported, gets greeted with this credit rating cut from S&P and puts it three levels above junk to BBB+. Moody's and Fitch is also reviewing the company's debt. A fine how do you do to Mr. Culp, because this will probably raise the company's borrowing costs as it is struggling with cash flow, and that is exactly what S&P cited in its downgrade. The power business, saying it will again cause cash flow and earnings to be below expectations. And as we've been saying on the show, it was the power business, the lack of progress there.
Yeah, as if
cost John Flannery his job.
As if his job isn't challenging enough. We're going to speak with Shirley Leung in our 5 o'clock hour about why GE is still very good for Boston, no matter what the company's woes. And then coming up next, we are going to speak with Bloomberg opinion writer Brooke Sutherland on why maybe this decision wasn't handled in the best way, the CEO shakeup. This is Bloomberg Bay State Business, 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Peter Barnes and Janet Wu. I'm Pat Carroll. Now, more on GE, which did close higher again today, 1.9%. But its woes continue, with the S&P Global Ratings cutting the company's bond rating today. As GE pulled the plug on homegrown CEO John Flannery and then brought in Larry Culp, there are questions of whether that'll be enough to save the struggling company. Bloomberg Opinion's Brooke Sutherland joins us now. GE finally went outside to find a leader, but you still don't think they went far enough. Can you explain what more they should have done?
I think Larry Culp is a very successful CEO in the industrial space. He's had a very strong track record when he was at Danaher. But a couple of things here. For one, I just thought it was very interesting that they named Larry Culp CEO and chairman. This has long been a rallying cry for critics of GE that they should separate the CEO and chairman roles, and GE has resisted that. And to me, this just seemed like a perfect opportunity to set a precedent, not only for Larry Culp, but also for future leaders of both GE and other companies. And I just think, you know, going back to what I said, Culp is a skilled executive, but his experience at Danaher was extremely different than what he's going to encounter at GE. And I, one of the things I think is interesting is he's repeatedly been portrayed in other news stories as a turnaround expert. And that's not really what he was. He built a company through acquisitions, and he was very good at it. He was good at making those businesses that he acquired much more valuable. But he didn't have to deal with the sort of, you know, rather grave situation that we're seeing at GE. Right. You know, there were never any sort of serious questions about Danaher's leverage profile. And obviously, as you just said, you know, GE's credit ratings are cut. We could see cuts coming from Moody's and Fitch in the coming days. And so I just think it's a much more challenging situation and a very different situation than what he had to deal with at Danaher. And it might have been helpful to have an extra set of eyes.
So the extra set of eyes would have been to split the job.
Yes.
So, since they did not do that, Brooke, is the only other check that they could possibly strengthen, would that be changing the board?
So they've already made a number of changes to the board. That's how Larry Culp came into the picture in the first place. He was added in April, along with Tom Horton, who's the former CEO of American Airlines, who now becomes independent lead director. You know, in the statement that they put out this week, Larry Culp referred to the opportunities for continued board renewal. So I do read that as more changes are likely coming to the board. I think you'll see pretty much all of the old guard that was around in the Jeff Immelt era likely be cleaned out and replaced with fresher voices. So we'll just have to wait and see, you know, who those are and what those changes actually look like.
We're speaking with Bloomberg Opinion columnist Brooke Sutherland about GE. Brooke, in the past when we were talking about you, you were in the give John Flannery more time camp. What do you think about this announcement, and was he treated fairly in your view?
I don't know if I would have characterized my perspective as give John Flannery more time.
A little
more
time.
Pretty critical of his mixed messages and, you know, not sometimes lack of decisiveness. I did feel like he was finding the right path with the breakup that GE announced. I feel like he was sort of finally coming into his own and finally had a path forward. But, you know, in retrospect, I think it was just a little too late. And I think he did have the right idea. I think ultimately he was trying to do the right thing for the company. He was trying not to be too knee-jerk about it. But the problem is that investors weren't really looking for that. They were looking for someone to be very aggressive and very decisive and, you know, fix some of these problems. And a lot of it is not John's fault. I mean, you look at
that's where I was going to go. The problems of the power division, which they hung on his neck yesterday, it appears, seem to be a market problem that were beyond John Flannery's control.
Well, I don't think it is just a market problem. Like John himself and GE has been very honest that they mismanaged that business. They were not prepared for this downfall. They bought Alstom, you know, right at the peak of the power market, significantly expanded their installed base at the exactly wrong time. So they definitely made poor decisions. They mismanaged that business. They were not prepared for this drop in demand. But at the same time, a lot of those decisions can ultimately sort of be traced back to the Jeff Immelt era. You know, Flannery played a role. He was head of M&A at the time that they did the Alstom deal, so he's certainly not blameless here. But he did not create a lot of these problems. He inherited them, and he just didn't move quick enough to fix them.
So more time wouldn't necessarily have helped.
You know, it might have helped. It just depends on sort of what your time horizon is if you're a GE investor. You know, I think what I have long said is that this is not a quick turnaround story. A lot of these problems are deep-rooted, and what we've discovered is that it goes to the heart of the GE culture and the way that this company was run, and that you needed to really have sort of a top-to-bottom rethinking of what GE was, not just culturally, but what sort of businesses is it actually going to be in. You're seeing some of that with the breakup steps that it's taking with spinning off healthcare and selling down the Baker Hughes energy assets. But GE is still a big company, even after, you know, all of the market value that it's lost. This is
right.
A big ship, and it takes some time to right it. And specifically with the power market there, you're not going to see that turnaround anytime soon. Those pressures in renewable energy are not going away. So, you know, this is just, even with Larry Culp at the head here, I don't think this is going to be a sort of a magical recovery that's going to happen quickly.
So, Brooke, they gave Flannery little more than a year before they showed him the door. How much time do you think they are going to give Culp?
I wouldn't necessarily expect him to have any sort of different time horizon. You know, I think what the board showed is that they are eager for change. They're eager for progress, which, you know, sort of goes back to my original point, is that Culp could have helped himself by bringing in an independent chairman. I mean, it sort of, in a way, buys you more time. It brings in another person to sort of share in the decision-making process, share in the accountability of this.
We are speaking to Brooke Sutherland of Bloomberg Opinion on the shakeup at GE. So you're saying that he'll probably be given about the same amount of time. What, in your opinion, do we have to see in the next year and not just a higher stock price?
I think one of the big initial things is in terms of communications with investors. I think, you know, one issue for John Flannery is he laid out 2018 guidance at that November Investor Day that was supposed to be his big coming out party where he laid out his vision for the company. And he sort of clung to those numbers even as market conditions made it clear to pretty much everybody else that those targets were unrealistic. And I think that's just not what we needed to see from GE at a time when people are already scrutinizing its accountability and transparency. And, you know, if you go back to the Jeff Immelt era, that was sort of a tactic that he was known for, was clinging to these overly optimistic targets well after they made sense. So I think you need to see from Larry realistic targets that he's going to make and, you know, a willingness to acknowledge when he's not going to make them. I think one thing that does worry me is that when GE announced this management change, they did so with an extremely short press release. There was no...
Right, they're not talking.
They're not talking. There was no slide deck. There was no conference call. There's not a lot of information, which if I'm an investor and I'm frustrated looking back at all these years at GE, I don't know that I'm necessarily going to take that as a positive sign.
Yeah, they'll have to talk at some point.
In our last 30 seconds, what's the future? A lot of folks up here are worried that the company now might be broken up by Larry Culp, which would, you know, affect jobs, the corporate headquarters here in Boston.
Yeah, I think it's already being broken up. You know, everybody sort of has a different definition of a breakup, but clearly they've said they're spinning off healthcare, they're selling down the Baker Hughes energy assets. The communication from GE has been that all of those moves will continue. I don't know at this point that we should expect sort of a breakup of aviation and power. It's possible longer term. I don't really think that's a smart strategic fit, but in the near term, given power struggles, that's not really tenable.
Thanks. That's Bloomberg Opinion's Brooke Sutherland with some insight into the doings at GE. Coming up, we'll talk markets with Rob Skloff of Silver Pine Capital. This is Bloomberg Bay State Business, 1061 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
To the markets now. Investors liken that new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal the president announced yesterday. The industrials up strong for a second day in a row on that news. Rob Skloff is the founder and portfolio manager for Silver Pine Capital, a wealth manager in Medfield, and he joins us now. So, Rob, I was talking to one of our colleagues about this today. The investors seem kind of complacent about trade wars generally. Do you get a lot of calls about trade wars?
No, not at all. You know, what I think is you've got so many people that are taking this all in stride. I mean, I think the biggest thing that the conclusion that I've come to is that it appears there's a bit of a method to Trump's madness. I don't think anyone was quite sure, but it seems to be, you know, the results are starting to play out, which is a little surprising, but welcome.
Well, if you read a little book called, Oh, Yeah, The Art of the Deal, you would have seen this coming. Start way over here, you know, with demands. And then, as he writes in his book, cut a deal that splits the difference.
Yeah. And you know, it does appear that it's a good setup for China. If I were the Chinese, I would be, I mean, you can see the writings on the wall. Mexico, even before that, you know, you have South Korea. It's setting up pretty good.
So let's talk about China. Do you think that actually what happened between Mexico and Canada showed a little bit too much of his hand?
I don't know. I mean, the trade imbalance is so big with China that it it doesn't seem to me that they have a whole lot to stand on, right? I mean, the U.S. is in such a strong position, and now that our two of our biggest trading partners have apparently lined up in Mexico and Canada, I think the Chinese are next.
But it's like an elephant compared to a golden retriever in a way in the size.
No, that's definitely true.
Yeah. And plus, what the administration is and the president's demanding of China is different from
that is definitely true.
From Canada and Mexico. He wants structural reforms to the Chinese economy. And you are a stock picker.
Correct.
And I'm just curious if any of the stocks that you pick, and you do what, mainly small cap and mid cap?
Small mid cap, yeah, that's our strength.
Are any of them, do you take this into account when you're trying to pick stocks?
I mean, I think you take
the vulnerability to international.
You do. You try to see through it if you think it's a short-term event. You know, one of the names we've been looking at recently is a company called Rev Group, and they were hurt in their most recent quarter by what's going on, by the ability to get parts. They had some supply constraints, and the stock is essentially cut in half over the last year, which we think sets up very nicely. It's a company that we think has $2 in earnings power. It's right around $14.50. So you look at the multiple and you say at seven and a half times, it's pretty cheap. Think it could double in the next couple of years.
So your firm started right after the crash. And so small cap stocks have been good for you, but are you going to change your strategy from here forward?
No, you know, you're right. They have been. I don't know how to do anything any other way. I simply look for companies that are out of favor and try to buy them when no one else is looking. And by the time people start paying attention to it, we've kind of wrung out our gain and move on.
We had some Bloomberg analysis today that shows this rift between large cap and very small cap stocks, using one of my favorite words, bifurcating, if you will, that large caps went up for a second day in a row, while equally percentage-wise, small caps went down.
You know, the last couple of months, the smaller companies, the small mid-sized guys that I look at have been really sucking wind. September was not a very good month at all. But, you know, we try to look at it in a much bigger picture, and we're just trying to find companies that have the characteristics that we like to see in the long haul, and we're not trying to speculate what's going to happen over the next quarter or two. Although we'll be happy if that happens, if a trade deal does happen in the short run. You know, some of the smaller retailers that we had kind of been buying up earlier in the year, like, well, not so small, but Macy's, which is obviously a much bigger name, Tractor Supply, some of these companies have doubled, you know, up 50, 60, in Macy's case, up 100% over the last 9 months.
Rob Skloff is the founder and portfolio manager at Silver Pine Capital in Medfield. He has about $35 million under management. Jay Powell was in town today. Speaking, Fed chair, do you have any thoughts on Fed policy, rising interest rates? Are you concerned at some point higher rates will start to have knock-on effects on equities?
You know, honestly, I'd be concerned if we weren't raising rates. I mean, we've been in this artificially low interest rate environment for 9 years, which was wholeheartedly necessary to get us off the brink of, you know, financial Armageddon. However, we have to have some dry powder in case things were to go awry. We've had a very long run of prosperity, and with interest rates where they are, we have to go higher and normalize.
Tell us about your typical client and what you're telling them.
Yeah, you know, our clients get the way we look at the world. We were talking a little about the large caps having run so much recently. You know, there are only a handful of really mega caps, I would argue, that are powering the market. And, you know, when you think about some of the, you know, Tesla, for instance, Tesla, although it's been a very volatile name, it's a $60 billion enterprise value for a company that doesn't make any profit. That's something very difficult for me as a value securities analyst to get my hands around. Really cool cars, but, you know, very, very rich valuation. Everything has to go right. And they have to raise debt. But as far as our clients, they get the way we look at the world, and they're looking out at the much bigger picture, not necessarily what's going to happen over the next 6 or 12 months.
Rob Skloff, Silver Pine Capital. You mentioned earlier that it's not going to last forever, the good times. Do you have clients that are looking ahead and listening to that report yesterday about the number of economists who are predicting and analysts who are predicting a recession by 2020 or so.
You know, I think recessions, I mean, that's part of the cycle. It's not a, it's become a negative word. I think what's more important is how long it lasts and how deep it goes. But, I mean, it would be abnormal not to have one. So I think it's very normal that we would have one, and I think people are preparing for it.
You talked about needing dry powder. What percentage of cash do you recommend? And for your clients?
That's a pretty good question. We typically would only have a handful, you know, 3 or 4%. We are now, in some cases, up to 15 and 20%. I think it's just really important. I would rather sacrifice some of the upside now, being prepared in case things go awry, because they likely will go sooner rather than later.
What else is keeping you up at night?
Oh, boy, what is keeping me up at night? I mean, I get concerns. You know, I was a young analyst in the late 90s, and it feels eerily similar, especially I hearken back to the Teslas of the world, even Amazon. You know, these are companies that are amazing and transformative, but the valuations are, you're just looking out as far as the eye can see, and I still can't make sense of it. So
the value guys is not going to capitulate to the
growth. I don't know what else to do. What I try to do, we as a firm try to buy growing companies that have just made a mistake. You know, they've misstepped, and the value becomes much different. SeaWorld, for instance, ticker SEAS. This is a company back in April of 16. They had the Blackfish documentary, and the stock was $15 a share. It's now $30. And lo and behold, revenues are growing 9% organically. Attendance is up 10%. I mean, things have changed dramatically. That's what we're looking for.
Rob Skluff of Silver Pine Capital. You can check out a copy of Benjamin Graham's securities analysis book right there on the corner of that desk as you head for the exit tonight. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having
insight.
Me.
Well, just ahead, more on Fed Chair Jay Powell's visit to Boston today. This is Bloomberg, Bay State Business, 1061 Boston Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore. Well, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell was in Boston today speaking at the annual meeting of the National Association for Business Economics. Our Federal Reserve reporter Christopher Condon was there. Earlier, we asked Chris for the top headline from Powell's remarks.
Well, number one, Peter, the Fed is still on the same track that we thought they were on. Steady, gradual hikes, probably one more this year, three more, which are penciled into their projections for next year. So no change to that expected path for rates over the next year. And the second thing I'd mention, he made very clear that he's not disturbed at all by the recent uptick in wages and what that might mean for inflation. He's not worried about inflation. If it goes a little bit above 2%, it's not bothering him at this point. He's much more focused in that sense in keeping an eye on inflation expectations, which anchor the long-term trend that inflation will follow. It's very important in the formation of inflation. He's made it clear that if inflation expectations become unanchored, then they'll act very quickly and quite aggressively if they have to.
Let's talk about this measured growth, the challenges of staying between an overheated economy and a stagnant one.
Right. Well, this is, at this point in the business cycle, I have to say, this is a real trick. The Fed has almost never pulled off what they call a soft landing. Only once before, you can say, in the 1990s, Greenspan pulled this off, coming out of an interest rate hiking cycle without ending up in a recession. That's a really hard job to do, especially when unemployment is below what economists refer to as full employment, which is the kind of equilibrium level that unemployment will end up at when the economy is going well. That gets very hard to manage the unemployment back up a little bit. Keep things all, you know, financial stability in line, keep markets from overheating and inflation overheating. Fed does not have a very good record of doing that.
Christopher Condon is a Federal Reserve reporter for Bloomberg News. And to follow up on that point, we saw Jay Powell, who is not an economist. He's a lawyer and a business guy by training, do quite a lengthy presentation on
drum roll, please, the Phillips curve.
Equations and everything up on the PowerPoint board. Well, make no mistake, Jay Powell does not have a PhD, but he is no slouch in understanding the research and being up to his elbows in that. He's done it since he joined the Fed, I think, in 2012. He's a voracious reader of economic research. He's used the resources of the vast staff of PhDs at the Fed to put that to good use. He's been a great student of economics, it does seem, so he's no stranger to that. He can hold his own with the PhDs, I must say.
I like to consider the worst of all possible outcomes, and that's recently great. Heard from Rosengren of the Boston Fed expressing concern over our readiness for another downturn and the ability to use hikes because they are already so low. Has he expressed the same concern?
Powell has definitely flicked at that. Let's face it, first of all, another recession is inevitable. We don't know when it's going to happen, but there will inevitably be another recession, and we're very late in this expansion. And if that comes now or any time, say, in the next year or even 2 years, where will interest rates be? They won't be, historically speaking, very high. What's the main tool for fighting a recession at the Fed? Pushing interest rates down. Highly likely that the next recession will see the Fed once again going straight down to that floor. And they have to start doing unorthodox things again. And Powell, even today, made it clear. He doesn't like to come out and trumpet this, but when he was pushed in some of the Q&A afterwards, made clear that if it's necessary, the Fed will definitely resort again to large-scale asset purchases.
Okay, you said the word trumpet.
No,
that means we get to talk about President Trump.
That's a good segue.
Was the president's kind of pressure campaign on the Fed? Was that part of the conversation at this meeting?
Didn't come up today, but it's been in the air. He was questioned about it at last week's press conference. He has a pretty good stock answer that they do what they do. They don't consider politics when they're in the room. The transcripts of past meetings show that historically has been the case. So there's not really much reason to believe that they're changing the discussion when the Federal Market Committee meets to include that in the discussion of what to do with monetary policy.
All right. I sat here, though, and I listened to every word that Jay Powell said, Chris Condon, Bloomberg News Federal Reserve reporter. And when the issue of fiscal policy came up, I thought that Powell's comments were interesting on that.
It's another, trade, it's another area where Powell always starts with, well, you know, we like to stay in our lane. In other words, we don't like to get into the area that's in within the authority of Congress or the White House and then attract the displeasure. That's a dangerous thing for the Fed. But nonetheless, you know, this affects the economy, whether it's trade or fiscal policy. And he made clear there's a longstanding recognition at the Fed that in the long run, you know, an unsustainable debt load is not good for the U.S. economy. He repeated that, made it very clear that the recent tax reforms, air quotes here, have contributed to the worrying outlook for the long run debt of the U.S. Although he said it's not an immediate problem. He said they still
That's
have fiscal space.
When my ears picked up.
They still have fiscal space.
That's when I perked up.
That may be optimistic. He's technically correct, of course, but when the next recession occurs, does that mean Congress is going to say, oh, yeah, we've got fiscal space. Let's just go right full steam ahead with a fiscal stimulus to help us get out this recession and we'll worry about the debt later? I'm not so sure about that.
All right. Chris Condon up from Washington covering Jay Powell's comments today here in Boston. Thanks for the briefing.
My pleasure.
And, of course, the concern about Jay Powell coming up here to make remarks was that he just had a press conference last week with the Fed's latest decision, policy decision last week. However, he did have a Q&A here, and this is with business economists, so he got a few questions that he might not have gotten asked by journalists at a press conference. He was asked, for example, about asset bubbles, and he said, you know what? Don't see any asset bubbles right now. He says asset prices are high by historical standards, but he said he was worried as the Fed backs out of, well, as it remains accommodative, that there might be asset bubbles, but he says he doesn't see any.
So we follow Jay Powell wherever he goes, because Chris Condon follows him wherever he goes, up from Washington, D.C. today. And we've also been following GE, all the recent shakeups and woes. They just won't end. We reported earlier that S&P Global Ratings cut the company's bonds rating. And this, of course, the day after the ouster of CEO John Flannery. We are going to be joined in a little while by Shirley Leung, the interim editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. She says that despite the company's woes and as it continues to unwind businesses, it still is great for Boston. And she's going to come on and tell us exactly why. This is Bloomberg Bay State Business, 1061 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
Every day at this time, we bring you the top story on the Bloomberg Terminal, and it is about the Kavanaugh nomination. Headline is, Kavanaugh College Visit to Bar Erupted in Fight, classmate says. And this is based on a police report that reveals a 1985 arrest of a future NBA player who was a friend of Brett Kavanaugh's. The player is Chris Dudley, who later played basketball at Yale, where Brett Kavanaugh attended school. Dudley played for the Knicks and the Nets at one point. He, Kavanaugh, and another friend, Charles Luddington, got into a spat at a bar in a case of mistaken identity. Kavanaugh first cursed at a person, and then after the man responded in kind, Kavanaugh threw a beer in his face, said Luddington. Janet.
Peter, we live in one of the most expensive housing markets in the country, obviously. Today, the mayors of 15 greater Boston cities and towns gathered in front of a Somerville housing development to announce a collective effort to bring new units online for people of all income levels. Bloomberg's Anne Mostu was there.
The conversation about the housing crisis is shifting from affordable housing to all income levels, and local leaders are finally putting a number on their plans, 185,000 new units of housing by the year 2030.
The partnership immediately began working to identify and set clear, specific, achievable goals for addressing the serious housing needs of the entire Metro Boston area.
That's Somerville Mayor Joseph Curtatone. He and mayors from Newton to Braintree say they're considering more than just population growth or supply and demand. They're also factoring in transportation, climate change, and the opioid epidemic. And they're promising more homes for all types of households and income levels, for owners and renters. The Metropolitan Area Planning Council says it's not just that we have a housing shortage, it's that too many people are overspending on housing. Mark Drayson is executive director of the council.
One out of every 10 homeowners and one out of every 4 renters currently pay over half of their income to cover housing costs. This is a burden even for those who are well off.
Drayson praised the effort of local leaders. He says it's just a start and that Eastern Massachusetts will need 435,000 units of housing by 2040 to meet demand. Anne Mostu, Bloomberg 1061, Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
Coming up, we will have more analysis on the woes of GE. They seem to just keep piling on. Specifically, we'll talk about the impact of all these problems on Boston and our economy and the fact that GE is a corporate member of our city. At 5:16, we'll be joined by Shirley Leung, interim editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. This is Bloomberg Bay State Business, 1061 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore. Remember all the fanfare when GE announced its move to Boston? In the year it's been here, the company has been on a sad downward spiral, its stock losing about half of its value that last year, and we all know already well below its highs. And yesterday, the CEO of just 1 year was abruptly ousted by the board and replaced by a turnaround specialist. Now, despite all those woes, Shirley Leung of the Globe says GE is a net positive for Boston, and she joins us now. Thank you so much.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You say the incentives and deals to bring GE here were very smartly done. Explain why.
Yes, so the state and the city did not hand a blank check or even a check to General Electric. Specifically, the state's portion, they put up about $125 million to buy and rehab two old Necco Candy buildings in the seaport in the South Boston. And that's one of the, you know, hottest real estate markets in the country. Everyone wants to be there, including like Amazon is a neighbor of General Electric in that particular location. And so the state bought these two buildings. General Electric will lease them. And so if GE were to decide we're not going to be in Boston anymore, we're leaving, the state is left with two pieces of prime real estate. So they don't lose anything as long as the real estate market stays really good. Now, with the city of Boston, right now, GE hasn't triggered any incentives. That's because the first phase of the headquarters is rehabbing these old buildings. The second phase is building a new 12-story tower. And the city's incentives do not only apply to this new building. And to fully benefit from the $25 million in property tax breaks that the city of Boston is offering, GE has to create 800 jobs. I'm not holding my breath that the new tower will be built. I mean, GE says that they're still on plan to build that new tower after they finish the first phase. But let's say the new tower never gets built. That means the city of Boston doesn't have to pay a dime in tax breaks to GE.
So Shirley Leung of the Boston Globe, what do you think of this announcement?
Well, it came as a surprise. John Flannery has only been at GE for I think 14 months, and he seemed to be doing everything that the board or shareholders wanted, which is to radically restructure GE and cut costs. But the stock kept on sinking, and my colleagues on the news side were reporting that one of the reasons why, and I've read this in other places too, is that Flannery was all about cutting. He didn't come up with enough plans to grow revenue. And so the thinking is the new guy, Larry Culp, who joined the board this spring, will come in and needs to come up with a plan to drive revenue, not just cut its way, not just have GE cut its way to profitability.
When you think about it, with three CEOs since moving to Boston, that did seem pretty daunting. But you say that they were already wounded when they got here, and they really weren't going to get any better if they stayed in Connecticut. Why?
Exactly. So, amid the hoopla of GE moving to Boston, because it's a really big deal for Boston to win out over New York and other cities to have GE uproot itself from its longtime home in Connecticut to Boston. And perhaps lost in all that hoopla was that it was already in the middle of a massive turnaround. Jeff Immelt, the CEO two CEOs ago, he was already trying to turn around this old industrial company. He had sold off a lot of businesses, and he was trying to get into this Internet of Things, industrial internet. And the reason why they came to Boston is because they wanted to be in the center of innovation. They wanted to be able to recruit grads from MIT. They wanted to be at the intersection of healthcare and technology and life sciences.
Kind of absorb all the energy.
Exactly. And they weren't going to be able to do that in Fairfield, Connecticut. And
looking Jeff at the Immelt, deer.
Yeah, he used to famously say he didn't want to look out the window and see deer. He wanted to look out the window and, run into an engineer from MIT.
We're talking with Shirley Leung, interim editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. So, Shirley, do you think a floundering GE will have no impact on Boston's ability to lure other big companies here if we go after them?
You know, ever since GE decided to move to Boston, all these other companies followed suit. Amazon was here, but is expanding quite dramatically in Boston. I'm not even talking about the second headquarters. And a whole host of other companies have decided to come to Boston. I don't think people associate GE's misfortunes with Boston. I mean, we're not a curse. Where GE was already wounded when it arrived. But at the same time, I think what there's an opportunity for the city of Boston and for our region if it could be the place where an old company like GE comes to Boston and gets and can be transformed for the future. I mean, that's a great message for other companies to come to Boston.
Shirley Leung of the Boston Globe. Are you concerned at all that all these changes may hurt GE's ability to deliver on its promises to Boston and the state?
Well, right, they've 50 million
for education and all that.
Right, right, and they've so far stuck on track to that. I don't think they'll. I don't know. It would be really pretty bad headlines, right, if they decided to take that money away from the city of Boston's public schools. And that comes from a separate foundation. I do think one of the questions is, will they create 800 jobs, headquarter jobs here? I think there are about 250 jobs now. How many more jobs will this company that has dramatically shrunk already in 3 years. How many headquarter jobs will they create? Will they build that 12-story tower? Will the, you know, I think they're filling about 100,000 square feet, you know, these two old candy buildings, which are supposed to open next year. You know, will that be enough? And,
sure.
And it may be that, you know, maybe it's only 300, the headquarters is only 300, and there's talk of shrinking headquarters staff anyways.
Shirley, do you think, very quick question, that very quick answer, do you think the headquarters will be built?
Well, it's under construction. Seeing is believing. I got a hard hat tour in last month or in August, and so I know they will have a presence in Boston. It's a question of how big of a presence.
All right. It's always great to speak with you, Shirley Leung of the Boston Globe. And coming up, shared workspaces are all the rage, but they're mostly for companies that don't need complicated equipment. Did you know there is shared lab space for early biotechs here? And of course, this was pioneered in our area. We'll speak with the founder of Lab Central and why he was moved to create not only shared lab space, but to make this business nonprofit. This is Bloomberg Bay State Business, 1061 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore. You don't need us to tell you that Boston-Cambridge is the biotech center of the universe. And despite an explosion of building in Kendall Square, there is a dire shortage of both office and lab space for new companies. Enter Lab Central, which offers share lab space for approximately 60 or more biotech startups. It's located in a 70,000 square foot MIT-owned building, and they have another 30,000 square feet across the street in a Pfizer building. All this in the heart of the action on Main Street in Cambridge. We're talking about 100,000 square feet of very smart people trying to cure tough diseases. So co-founder Peter Parker joins us now, and let's get it out of the way. This is the biotech Peter Parker, not the Spider-Man Peter Parker.
That's okay. You know, I have to save the city later tonight, so I'll, you know, I'll do my job here and then put on the uniform.
Fly away. Peter Parker, thank you so much for your good work. So let's ask you, what was the inspiration for doing this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually was running a biotech company with my partner, Johannes Fruhoff, back in the kind of OOs. And when we went out to look for lab space, there wasn't any, which meant you had to go get a lease from somebody, fit up your space, get a contractor, get an architect, buy equipment. It took us 7 months before we ran our first experiment, and we had venture capital money that whole time. So that's just 7 months completely lost, no science. And, you know, we were able to get through that, sell that company in 2010, and then we both looked at each other and said, there has to be a better way. And this was in a time when Y Combinator and other sort of tech incubators were changing the way those things were done, and we just wanted to apply that model to biotech.
So tell us what your business model is.
Well, that's a better question, maybe. So I'm a longtime venture capitalist, and I actually helped start a firm called Ampersand Capital out in Wellesley, Mass. Very, very well-known firm now. I left to run this biotech company that I mentioned before. But, you know, what I saw, we're a nonprofit at Lab Central, and as such, we have access to state money. So we've used about $10 million of Massachusetts money to build out the facility. We attract a lot of sponsor money because of what we do. I like the nonprofit mission because it puts the focus on entrepreneurship and innovation, curing disease. I mean, things that I really want to do. But to be honest, you know, I'm greedy too, and so I'm able to invest in a few of these companies along the way. There's no prescription against that. They can take money from anyone who comes in, doesn't have to
and
be money.
And you simply charge them rent for the space.
Right. Yeah. The business model is pretty simple. They pay rent, and we make up the difference. We lose money if it's just on rent, and we make up the difference with sponsorships that we sell to large pharma.
But why not take equity? You could be making a pretty penny if you took equity in these companies.
True. And there are models that tried that before, and we were very informed by those. Many of them failed, and they also failed to attract the absolutely best companies in the ecosystem. And so we have a partner, a third partner, Tim Rowe, who runs the Cambridge Innovation Center, and he's very well known here. And Tim was on the same page with us and really influenced our decision to just don't even ask that question. You know, you can decide if they're good companies later because you're their landlord. You're basically around them every day. You know who's working hard, whose stuff is going to actually work, which science would work. And, why provide equity early on? I mean, there's really no reason. The space is so attractive, so fully functional, and so unique that brings in the best companies.
We're speaking with Peter Parker, co-founder of Lab Central. How many startups do you have right now, and how do you choose?
Yeah, so we have about 70 in the locations that Janet mentioned. We actually also operate a lab at Harvard at the business school. It's called the Life Lab. It was funded by the Paliukas, but we are the intel inside, the operators of it. There's another 25 companies over there. So we have a pretty wide net, and, the companies graduate. They don't leave, on any schedule, but they leave when they're ready. So we've had a couple hundred companies come through our lab. We select them through a pretty rigorous process. They actually have to submit a form online. We then interview them either in person or over the phone. And for the ones we think are working on important enough problems, we then bring them through a selection committee meeting. I always thought that was cheeky because we're actually asking them to pay rent to us. Mm-hmm. But we choose them. And they make a presentation, and we take about 20% of the companies that initially apply.
Peter Parker is the co-founder of Lab Central in Cambridge. So tell us the names of some of these companies without getting all your some of your children angry.
Yes.
And tell us what some of them do. What are some of the discoveries that they're making?
Sure. I mean, there's some very high-profile companies that have come through Lab Central. You probably know Rubius, which has gone public this year. That started at Lab Central, technology that, Harvey Lodish was very involved with out of the Whitehead Lab. Harvey remains very, very close to us and brings visitors and other companies through our lab all the time. But that company really started with, very small beginnings and has able to work through, significant financing rounds and up through public. They left probably a year or so ago. So they get large enough where we can't accommodate them anymore. Another one is Surface Oncology that went public this year. We've had several other companies that are, kind of high flyers. I mean, right now in our space, there are companies like Pandion, which is working on a very, very interesting treatment for inflammation, where you would treat it locally and not have to take systemic drugs. Anybody who's dealt with Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis or any of the systemic, autoimmune inflammatory diseases, they take horrible medicines and most of them don't work. So this is a big problem.
We should point out there is nothing else like this anywhere.
No, I don't think there is. Certainly there's not a nonprofit, fully functional lab, and certainly not at this scale. You know, universities have incubator labs, and we don't compare ourselves to them because, you know, we take all comers. Usually universities are very focused on their own graduates and faculty. We are, we're sponsored now by 15 of the 20 largest pharmas in the world. Now, that sounds like a nice source of revenue for us, but that actually helps make these companies better. They go faster. They just do more smart things because they get to talk to these people. And there is no other laboratory anywhere in the world with that kind of support from the, essentially, the buyer community. These are the folks who are going to end up, you know, owning these compounds and these companies. Yeah.
Is there any cross-pollination among these companies kind of working side by side?
There is at many levels. A couple of folks from different companies have gotten married and have children, but you don't mean that kind of...
That wasn't what I meant, but it's interesting.
No, they do. They collaborate. Obviously, they're not showing each other the secret sauce, but this is a very public space. They can't hide, so... we've had several companies join together to, submit grants together for NIH funding to actually, one would make products for other companies, or there are several companies that have actually become service providers to the other companies. We haven't had no mergers, et cetera, but I think, you know, it's just an amazingly collaborative space.
All right. Well, on those marriages, what happens in the lab stays in the lab. But actually, no. We're happy that what happens in the lab is coming out into the real world to save lives. And Peter Parker, that's amazing
work. Well, it is biology.
It is biology. We've been speaking with Lab Central co-founder Peter Parker. Please come back. Our conversation wasn't nearly long enough. And stay with us because Denise Chisholm, sector strategist at Fidelity Investments, gives us the 411 on the changes in equity sectors in the market. This is Bloomberg Base 8 Business, 1061 Boston Newburyport, 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
Well, you may have heard about some changes coming to the designations of the sectors in the market and the companies that go in them. Denise Chisholm is a sector strategist with Fidelity Investments. Earlier, I asked her to explain them.
S&P and MSCI recategorizing some of the sectors. It's three of the 11 sectors that are actually impacted, and just under 10% of market cap is changing. And they're doing this because over the last decade, let's say, the way we communicate and access media and entertainment has become slightly interwoven. And they wanted to give a nod to that thematically. So what they're doing is expanding the telecommunications services sector, which are stocks that you know, like AT&T and Verizon, and they're changing it to be the communication services sector and taking from technology, internet, and from consumer discretionary, media and entertainment. So that will be a new sector, one that looks very, very different from the telecommunication services sector we see today.
So what stocks are moving where?
So categorically, I think broad brush, just easiest to understand, internet is moving from technology to communication services.
So this would be Facebook and Alphabet, for
example.
That's
right. That's right.
Okay.
And media and entertainment is moving from discretionary to communication services.
So those would be what? Activision, Electronic Arts,
Disney,
Netflix.
Yep.
Okay. So what does that mean for specific sector funds and ETFs?
Sure. So I think that, you know, to sort of put forward the wisdom that Fidelity has talked about in the past by Peter Lynch, know what you own. So investors who are investing in these three sectors today have to understand that they are going to own potentially different stocks and different sort of risk weightings. The biggest thing that you should notice is that telecommunication services used to be a high dividend yielding, very defensive sector. That means it had strong odds of outperformance in a down market, an economic recession, or a profits recession. That is changing. So it's gone from a low beta, high dividend yielding sector to a beta above one, meaning that it's economically sensitive. So it isn't protective in the same way.
So investors need to be aware that now some sectors may perform differently.
Correct.
In the future.
You got it.
In this new categorization.
That's exactly right.
Okay. What does it mean for fund managers and ETF managers and companies like Fidelity. What have you been doing to prepare? What have you been telling your clients?
So for actively run funds that are diversified, it means nothing. In the sense that the stocks you own are still the stocks you own. It just may roll up to a different level. So it doesn't impact them at all, nor does it really impact any actively run sector funds, because you can still have out of benchmark exposures within technology or within media. And because it was thematically the same sort of basket that people were talking about, it may not change at all. Now, from what you own on the passive side, the ETF, if you owned an ETF based on telecommunication services, it will change to communication services. So that's the big difference in terms of what you own. And if you own a technology ETF, and this is an important distinction as well, it will lose internet exposure, which is sort of a big theme that investors have sort of focused on and identified.
So going forward, will it change the performance? It sounds like it will change the performance of some of these passive sector funds and ETFs.
Certainly. You're going to have different stocks in them. So of those three, of those 11 sectors, that will by nature change the performance. I think that there's a big concern if technology is losing internet. Are people going to want to own it? What's interesting to me from a historical perspective is as much as that's the growth, and they are certainly higher margin businesses that we can see as we strip out the data, what's interesting is that you get more valuation than you give up in growth, meaning that you actually have higher odds of outperformance from the relative valuation level from the technology sector that's going to be left behind.
So ahead of all this, and with all the education around it, have you been seeing investors, selling some of these funds and ETFs to buy others and vice versa?
So, look, the market is big and liquid. I don't think I'm ever going to be able to tell you what I see on an individual basis. What I will see is short-term disruptions are always possible, but over any medium to long-term, the stocks are going to follow the fundamentals of the stocks. The stocks are going to follow, performance is going to follow the fundamentals of the stocks. So people aren't going to necessarily be selling, internet to the extent that internet provides better business fundamentals, right? So I think it'll all work itself out in the long term.
And explain once again why Dow Jones, S&P Dow Jones, and MSCI are doing this specifically, because as I understand it, the last time they did this was, 1999?
They did REITs a little while ago. I can't remember exactly what year that was. I want to say a year and a half, 2 years ago. So they stripped out REITs from financials.
Okay. So, but as far as this kind of thing with technology and sectors, it's been a while.
It's been a long time. They're moving 10% of the market cap within the S&P 500 to a different sector. Mm-hmm. And I think they're trying to do it. I can't really speak for them, but in all the literature that I've seen from them, I think they're doing it to give a nod to the change in the supply chain between the way we communicate and access entertainment, it being sort of one big supply chain that they're trying to say you can invest on this thematically.
Yeah. And it reflects the fact that these companies have really matured and, gone from being, as you said, kind of growth companies, and maybe they still are. Mm-hmm. But the point being is that they're now mature. They're more kind of utility-like, if you will.
They're big enough to matter,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. They're really big enough to matter.
Yes.
All right. Denise Chisholm, sector strategist with Fidelity Investments. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I want to start a little bit here with the show that we have for tomorrow. Steve Grossman will join us. He is the former state treasurer who now heads the Initiative for a Competitive Inner City, ICIC. It's a nonprofit that works to improve economic conditions in inner cities through private sector investment to create jobs, income, and wealth for local residents. But we're going to have a very cool tech company on tomorrow for our weekly C-suite conversation. This week, it is the CEO of a company called Ori Systems, and it makes robotic furniture for small living spaces. And I urge everyone to go and look at the videos of this moving furniture on YouTube. It's unbelievable.
It's so
huge
cool.
Pieces.
Yeah, it can transform a single small space from a living room to a kitchen to a bedroom all instantaneously by moving these large pieces around. And basically, it allows all of those living spaces in like 400 square feet.
Yeah. So you have this giant thing next to your wall, and you push a button on the wall,
yep.
and it moves. And so you have what would be like a Murphy Betty thing, and it just unfolds, and then all of a sudden it moves to the center of the room, and you got a closet behind it, yeah. and all that. It's wild.
And if you want to have a party, just move it all to the side, and people can come into that small
space.
Well,
it's always a party here on our show, especially today. I'm Peter Barnes with Pat Carroll. Janet Wu sitting in for Tom Maroney, helping us with the party. This is Bloomberg Bay State Business, 1061 Boston Newburyport. And 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.